Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 824, titled Bringing It All Back Home Ukrainian Style, The Evolution and Triumph of Ukrainian Fascism. This is being recorded on December 4th of the year 2014. Before I get into the main body of the program, do get in the habit of subscribing to the comments that are made on the SpitfireList.com website. I have a contributing editor who posts under the name of Terra Fractal, PTERRAFRACTYL, who makes some very important and substantive contributions. Others do as well. By subscribing to those comments, you will be subscribing to a regularly updated information flow. The SpitfireList.com website is far more than just Dave Emery at this point. Now, to the program material itself. I've been doing a lot of work about Ukraine. There are many reasons for that. For one thing, there is nuclear saber-rattling once again going on the part of the West and Russia. We have, I wouldn't say slipped, because I think this was designed a long time ago. We are now entering a new Cold War, and beyond that, there is the possibility of a hot war. I don't think that the possibility of a Third World War has ever been greater. Not only is the West effing with Russia, we're effing with China, using Islamic proxy warriors of the Muslim Brotherhood strike both against Russia and against China, and we are attacking, that is to say the West is attacking in the West, from the West with Ukrainian fascists. Now, what we're going to be doing in this program is outlining the historical evolution of Ukrainian fascism, which is very much dominant in the current government of Ukraine that came into power in the Maidan coup of earlier this year. The Ukrainian diaspora is something that is front and center here, and we're going to be relying for most of the program on a very important article by George Eliason, or Eliason, I'm not sure how it is pronounced, that is capital E-L-I-A-S-O-N. We relied on a very important story that he did for the Record 783. The Ukrainian diaspora figures prominently in the evolution of Ukrainian fascism. We're going to be talking about that, and the other programs that I have done will supplement and complement this in a very important way. For the Record 778, For the Record 781, number 800, and others are very important in this regard. One of the things that we are going to be talking about is the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Habsburg Empire, or Habsburg Dynasty. Not only does George Eliason trace the evolution of Ukrainian fascism and the Ukrainian diaspora to the Austro-Hungarian Empire's Spring of Nations in 1848, but as we're going to see, in 1967, Yaroslav Stetsko, Stefan Bandera's number two man in the Ukrainian wartime collaborationist government and the head of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, he partnered with Otto von Habsburg in 1967 and developed the basically something which was a template for much of what we are going to be looking at in this program. Specifically, Otto von Habsburg headed up the European Freedom Council, which he co-founded with Yaroslav Stetsko. And we have also looked at the Habsburg dynasty in connection with the UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, which was headed up by Karl von Habsburg, his son. And Karl von Habsburg was for many years married to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza, the heiress to much of the Thyssen industrial empire. Interestingly enough, they got divorced, which Catholics are not supposed to do. I have noted in past discussion that the, quote, reconnaissance photographs purportedly showing a Russian invasion of Ukraine, something that did not actually take place, comes from a company called the Digital Globe, which was founded by veterans of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars program. Many of the executives in that have backgrounds with Bain & Company, the parent company of Mitt Romney's Bain Capital, and Information Handling Services, the epicenter of the peak oil movement. IHS, or Information Handling Services, is a wholly owned subsidiary of ThyssenKrupp Industries. And, of course, the Thyssen empire inextricably linked with the Bush family and the Underground Reich and Bormann Capital Network. So we're going to launch right into this. It is a lengthy essay and a very important one as well. The title of the essay, oh, by the way, before I get into this, the term Bandera here is used as a collective noun. It doesn't just refer to Stefan Bandera, the leader of the OUNB and the head of the Nazi collaborationist Ukrainian government that occupied Ukraine during World War II, then became a key element of the dominant element in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, the renaming of Adolf Hitler's Committee of Subjugated Nations. The Bandera here refer collectively to all of the, not only the Ukrainian fascist elements of the diaspora, but also other Eastern European fascist and ultranationalist elements that have evolved from the Austro-Hungarian Empire's Spring of Nations. So when you hear Bandera here, it is a collective noun. So if some of the verbs appear to be improperly conjugated, that is the reason why. Now, this article by George Eliason, again, E-L-I-A-S-O-N, from the Op-Ed News of August 1st of 2014 is titled, Ukraine, Why Bandera Had the Largest Geopolitical Voice in the EU. And part one of the series is Bandera, Into the House of Lector, L-E-C-T-O-R. I believe that refers to Hannibal Lecter of the Silence of the Lamb movies, the cannibalistic murderer who is, that's not a bad metaphor here. And George Eliason's Ukraine, Why Bandera Had the Largest Geopolitical Voice in EU reads as follows. Today, with the support of Europe, Australia, Canada, the U.S. directly, NGOs, the IMF, and the UN indirectly, Kiev enjoys an unparalleled geopolitical position. Whatever lie it tells is the new truth. Commentators have been scrambling to make sense of this, and of how Nazism could have popped up so boldly with the support of the free Western world. We're told it only plays a small part in what is going on in Ukraine, but history is often stranger than fiction, and in this case, fiction is the story you have been told. Ukraine is a paradox. There has never been a democratic-oriented government in Ukraine, and democratic protests were the ruse to get Western support. From the late 1980s to Ukraine's independence in 1991, the Bandera world leaders looked at Ukraine sensing independence would soon happen. Their greatest concern in the run-up to freedom was that there were no Nazis in Ukraine, or more precisely, only a few located around the Bandera capital of Lviv with no political power. From 1991, with the help of the U.S. and the EU, they have been preparing to change that fact radically. The paradox is that modern Ukraine's Nazi governments have always been active on the world stage. The only form of government the modern Ukrainian state has ever known has been the world's longest continuing and most extreme ultranationalist government that the planet has ever seen. The next section, where Ukrainian extremism started. This, by the way, relies on the book Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism by Paul Robert Magoski, M-A-G-O-S-C-I. In 1848, The modern Ukrainian state came into being under the Austro-Hungarian or Habsburg Empire in what is called the Spring of Nations. Under the Habsburg Empire, the Ukrainian people were first recognized as a distinct nationality and freed from the serfdom they had been under since the seat of the Rus Empire moved from Kiev to Moscow. In the Austria-Hungarian Empire, they were known as the Tyroleans of the East. The term means Austrians of the East. With their recognition as a people by Vienna, they acquired the Habsburg model of government. These countries include Galicia, West Ukraine, Ruthenia, R-U-T-H-E-N-I-A, West Ukraine, Estonia, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Austria, and Hungary. After World War I, Germany adopted this model, as did Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Slovenia, and Romania. When flushed out, this government model is an extreme form of ultranationalism. The only part of Ukraine recognized by the empire was Galicia, which was a major holding for the Habsburgs. Linguistically, there were four languages in what is now Ukraine. Ruthenians, also called Rusyns, R-U-S-S-Y-N-S, had a unique language. Galicia had its own, which is now called Ukrainian. The Dnieper Ukraine spoke a similar language. People in Little Russia, the southeast, which was outside of the Habsburg holdings, spoke Russian and were a part of Greater Russia. Western Ukraine was entirely devoted to the Austro-Hungarian Empire and was its strongest supporter in war. The next section, why ultranationalism or Nazism became the Eastern European model. The ultranationalist government model that the Austro-Hungarian Empire set out for the individual nations in the empire during the 1848 Spring of Nations set up a dual loyalty system that bound the countries inside the empire to Vienna's rule. Each country weeded out citizens that lacked total loyalty to the empire's ultranationalist patriotism or considered other forms of governance. They did this through pogroms and genocide. Each citizen's identity had to wrap around the exceptionalism as defined by the leaders of their country. Each citizen was first and foremost entirely devoted to the nation, demonstrated by national sacrifice or heroism. To be entirely devoted to nation involved an almost cultic devotion to the emperor and the Austro-Hungarian Empire that the nation was part of and belonged to, and Galician Ukraine became the Austro-Hungarian Empire's poster child. Ultranationalism shielded Habsburg West Ukraine from Russian influence outside and from Polish influence inside. It kept all of the empire's possessions from gaining too much influence in sister countries and competing for loyalties. In World War I, the Ukrainian state fought on the side of Germany with Austria-Hungary. They founded the Ukrainian Galician Army, which laid the foundation for the later Ukrainian Partisan Army of World War II and Bandera movements. With the breakup of the Habsburg Empire, the vassal states were freed by default, not by choice. With the empire gone, the only choice was to declare a republic or be absorbed by Poland. It should be noted that the ultranationalism displayed by Kiev today is neither original nor Ukrainian. Furthermore, most people are not aware that the other Habsburg remnant states display the same ultranationalist tendencies as Bandera Ukraine, but have not been able to become established as such. Another recent project is called Prometheanism. By the way, we looked for the record, 782, at the Promethean League. We also looked at that in AFA program number 14. Serge Schmemann of the New York Times editorial board is to be seen against the background of this. He went to college at the University of Paris under the Nazi occupation in the early 40s. I have suggested that his family background is suggestive of influence by the Promethean League. Again, for details, for the record, 782. Beginning again, Prometheanism as the root of Russian hate. Another recent project is called Prometheanism. According to Wikipedia, quote, the creator and soul of the Promethean concept was Marshall Pilsudski, who, as early as 1904 in a memorandum to the Japanese government, pointed out the need to employ the numerous non-Russian nations that inhabited the basins of the Baltic, Black, and Caspian Seas in its struggle against Russia, and emphasized that the Polish nation, by virtue of its history, love of freedom, and uncompromising stance toward the three empires that had partitioned Poland out of the political existence at the end of the 18th century, would, in that struggle, doubtless take a leading place and help achieve the emancipation of other Russians oppressed by Russia, other nations oppressed by Russia. This would be achieved by helping these nations to develop along strong ultranationalist lines. All the Promethean countries agreed to put any disputes behind them and work together until they were all free ultranationalist states. For Ukraine, from its inception as a recognized people in 1848, Nazism is the only form of government it has ever known. The short-lived governments that followed and continued in exile all these years were known for their unrelenting brutality and extreme ultranational characteristics. Next section, the roots of ultra-Bandera Ukraine's Russophobia. All ultranationalism functions by focusing on the national myth. This means that history and reality are irrelevant. The myth creates the nation that can do no wrong and is set above morality. The root of Galician hatred of Russia is based in its national myth. According to this myth, they are the sole heirs to Kiev Rus, the forerunner of their nation. They are the heirs of the language and the rightful rulers of all Rus people. According to the myth, the Muscovy Empire stole their birthright and language. This is what prompted the 2014 Moscow on the Nas murderous rage that is part and parcel of Ukrainian nationalism. At the same time, they point out that they were called Ukrainians and spoke the Ukrainian language in the days of Kiev and Rus to justify the nationalist myth that language is what binds them. And the reference here, History of Ukraine, Reverend Isidore Nyahusky, Ph.D., America Publishing House of the Providence, Association of Ukrainian Catholics in America. Continuing, the nationalist myth is a common denominator in every ultranationalist or Nazi country. In the case of Ukrainians, they consider that they have been done an irreparable wrong by history and that the only way to right it is to destroy Russia. From 1917 to 1921, Ukraine existed as three independent states, the Western Ukraine, and the Donetsk, D-O-N-E-T-S-K, Krivoy Rog Soviet Republic that was disbanded in 1918 and integrated with Soviet Ukraine. During this time, no Ukrainian government lasted more than a year before being overthrown by increasingly ultranationalists. However, the southeastern region was never a part of ultranationalist Ukraine. The government of West Ukraine, Galicia, and Ukraine formed a loose, mainly symbolic union based on ultranationalism. Each had its own national government, army, and laws. Simon Petliura, P-E-T-L-I-U-R-A, was one of the original leaders of the Habsburg countries to sign on to Prometheanism. But even as the recognized dictator of Ukraine, Petliura was forced to move the government into exile. The only acceptable form of government to a Ukrainian is the Galician or West Ukrainian model of extreme ultranationalism. Petliura is revered as a hero in Western Ukraine and a butcher everywhere else for his pogroms, torture, and murder. As the Soviet Union grew stronger, Poland set up what it and eventually the West as a whole would consider the only legitimate governments of the Promethean League countries. Promethean countries whose leaders emigrated. And then he lists them. One, the Ukrainian People's Republic to Poland, France, and Czechoslovakia. Georgia, note that, to France. Azerbaijan to Turkey and France. Cuban and Don That's K-U-B-A-N and Don, D-O-N, to Czechoslovakia. From Northern Caucasus Mountain National Center to Turkey. The Armenian National Center to France. The Tatar National Centers, Crimea, Idel-Ural, and Turkestan to Turkey, France, and Poland. Eventually, with the addition of a few more anti-Bolshevik countries in exile, they would be looked upon as a mini-United Nations by the West. The common denominators were that all are extremely ultra-nationalist and all have a common hatred for Russia. Prometheanism is still very active today, focusing on destroying the perceived Russian imperialism. Now on to the 1930s. History dealt another real slight to ultra-nationalist Ukraine by crediting the rise of Nazism to Adolf Hitler. After World War I, Germany also moved into the Habsburg model of independent governance. Hitler wasn't original, he just developed into the big kid on the block. Nazi Germany had little use for Nazi Ukraine until after the war started. German Nazi ideology was based on industrial fascism, while Ukrainian ideology was based on agricultural fascism. Ukraine was seen as a backwater to the German ultranationalists at the time, and this has not changed. Following the World War I breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Bandera were an ideal fit. The Germans were the sister empire to their own, and they expected the same kind of treatment. That fact made it natural for the Bandera to swear allegiance to the Third Reich forever. It was a slap in the face when they didn't get the same rights they had under the Empire. This fact, coupled with Hitler losing the war, are the only reasons they hate being called Nazis today. It's also why in some of the private armies operating in Ukraine today, they swear allegiance to the Third Reich ideal. Then on to World War II. These are the sections, by the way, that Eliasson has. Anyone who has followed Ukraine at all is well aware of Bandera's activities in World War II. The genocide of over 500,000 people in Ukraine, the SS divisions that the ultranationalists manned, fighting both against the Soviet Union and the Western Allies. The Bandera SS divisions also manned the concentration camps that became extermination camps during the war. The Bandera have never stood trial for crimes against humanity and never even had to apologize. By the way, interrupting briefly, many of the concentration camps, including Auschwitz, featured Ukrainian fascists of the OUNB prominently in their staffs. Next section, post-World War II. In 1946, three developments happened that profoundly changed the world we live in. The first happened as the ultra-nationalist Ukrainian emigre population settled into their host countries and started to participate as dual citizens. Keep in mind that other than for a brief few years, Ukrainian ultra-nationalism only existed as a government in the diaspora. At first, the ultranationalists were political extremists from a tiny region, and afterward only existed as a standing army in exile. During and after World War II, the Bandera army moved out of Ukraine, emigrating as a Nazi army to host countries all over Europe, Scandinavia, Australia, and farther west such as the U.S. and Canada. The Bandera were composed of, at minimum, four Waffen-SS divisions, as well as the large civilian army they maintained for genocide. The Bandera started taking public office as citizens of the host country and maintained representation in the Ukrainian government in exile. They joined political parties and pushed the host country's political ideologies toward the far right as they went. They worked together as a bloc to push for the destruction of the Soviet Union and the reinstatement of a government that would become Nazi Ukraine. Eventually, as office holders or advisors, they were in position to push Bandera's objectives in conjunction with the government in exile. The other Bandera, All associated groups described under the Promethean Project and below did the same thing, working hand in hand with the Ukrainian leadership. Eventually, this mix dominated all of Western politics, especially the conservative and ultra-liberal parties wherever they went, by stoking nationalist fervor and pride or exceptionalism. After 1947, they were recruited as agents in the Cold War. Eventually, across Europe and the West, they would run the Cold War and gain access to the highest positions of power on the continent and in the United States. Then Yaroslav Stetsko and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. By the way, that was initially formed in 1943 by Adolf Hitler as the Committee of Subjugated Nations. It's dominated by the OUNB, and its head for many years was Yaroslav Stetsko. His wife, Slava Stetsko, about whom we'll hear more later, became the head of it after her husband's death in 1986. Yaroslav Stetsko was Stefan Bandera's second in command and founder of many of the groups that would push for Ukrainian independence. Stetsko took over the world leadership of Bandera's OUNB faction in the late 1960s until 1986, when he died. He was never charged with crimes against humanity. The anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations was a group of extreme, ultra-nationalist Eastern European countries whose purpose was the destruction of the Soviet Union and communism by furthering the Promethean Project's aims. ABN countries were developed on ultra-nationalist foundations, and their acceptance across the West was due to their work during the Cold War. The ABN provided Europe with on-the-ground intelligence inside the Soviet Union, espionage experts inside the Soviet Union, propagandists that could communicate with people inside their respective bloc countries and disseminate anti-Soviet propaganda to the local populations, building nationalist tensions, raise funds for conservative and ultra-conservative candidates in countries across Europe and the U.S., NATO actionable intelligence. Bandera has been described as the only weapon needed to destroy the Soviet Union. This was due to its ability to infiltrate governments, influence policymakers, and get their own people into positions of power. ABN groups included the Bulgarian National Front from Bulgaria, the Belarusian Central Rada, RADA, from Belarus, the Cossack National Liberation Movement, the Croatian National Liberation Movement in Croatia, the Czech Movement for Freedom, the Za Svobodu, from the Czech Republic, the Czech National Committee, the Estonian Liberation Movement in Estonia, the Union of Estonian Fighters for Freedom, the Free Armenia Committee from Georgia, the Hungarian Liberation Movement from Hungary, the Hungarian Mindszenty Movement, that's M-I-N-D-S-Z-E-N-T-Y, named after Cardinal Mindszenty, the Latvian Association for the Struggle Against Communism in Latvia, the Lithuanian Rebirth Movement from Lithuania, the Slovak Liberation Committee from Slovakia, the National Turkestanian Unity Committee from Turkestan. And then the next section is called The Reemergence of the Ukrainian Government in Exile. When Simon Petliura, president of the government in exile, was assassinated in 1926, Andrei Levitsky took over. In 1945, Levitsky reactivated the government in exile of the Ukrainian National Republic and invited representatives of the new emigration to join it. In 1946, he instructed Isaac Mazepa, M-A-Z-E-P-A, to unite all political parties around the state center of the UNR, and that union eventually resulted in the organization of the Ukrainian National Council in 1947. In 1945, at the founding of the UN, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic was given founding member status. Eventually, through the work of the ABN, the UNC, and many other Bandera, including all captive nation countries under the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the UNC stepped into this position unofficially. Eventually, all factions of the Ukrainian diaspora would coalesce around the UNC and the government in exile of Ukraine. By the 1980s, the Ukrainian National Republic government in exile became the only representation of a free Ukraine for Europe, the West, and its allies. The Soviet Union that the world heard about during the Cold War until its collapse was the propaganda that the Bandera developed about Stalinism. In January of 1950, the Soviet Union offered a general amnesty to all Bandera fighters. During the 1950s, the Soviets pushed out the last of the Bandera guerrilla fighters, and after Stalin, the Soviets went through a period of de-Stalinization. This normalization made possible Bandera's resurgence in Ukraine. Normalization or Sovietification meant taking all the different republics in the Soviet Union and homogenizing them in order to create one nation. Part of that effort was to whitewash the Ukrainian Nazis from the history books, both to assimilate and protect primarily the Galician population that was left from retribution for the genocide Bandera committed in West, Central, and Eastern Ukraine. Because Nazism wasn't taught in school beyond the fact that it is evil, what Ukrainian ultranationalism is was forgotten. Most survivors of the atrocities just did not talk about it. Thus, in the 1990s, ultranationalism could emerge and remain unrecognized in plain sight, growing into the organizational force behind the Orange Revolution of 2004 and the Maidan coup in 2014. All the pro-coup forces present in 2014, including Tri-Zub Pravi Sector, were active in 1991. In the late 1940s and into the 1950s, Cold War fever spread across Europe. Governments began their move to the right and eventually to the far right, culminating in the United Kingdom with Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Communist sympathizers in government were ferreted out. Anti-communist groups such as the ABN became the go-to networks for intelligence and sabotage efforts. During the 1950s, Stetsko's ABN absorbed or destroyed every other group or network not previously aligned with it, and became the sole provider of intelligence to all of Europe's intel agencies and governments regarding the Soviet threat. This last sentence again, because it's pivotal. And by the way, against this background, this should be seen rather against the background of the Galen organization. During the 1950s, Stetsko's ABN absorbed or destroyed every other group or network not previously aligned with it, and became the sole provider of intelligence to all of Europe's intel agencies and governments regarding the Soviet threat. These were the only Eastern European government structures that Europe ever dealt with for over 50 years. By the way, the same could be said for the U.S. Continuing. During this time, European defense and foreign policy revolved around what their Bandera partners reported. When you consider everything that occurred during the Cold War, that is considerable. From the late 1940s until the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, MI5, British intelligence, dealt exclusively with the Bandera groups. Europe was introduced to all the various governments in exile, and especially the Ukrainian. These are the only Eastern European partners Europe ever knew. During this period, it became the policy of Western European countries to help free the captive Soviet bloc nations, support the governments in exile's claims for legitimacy, and to protect their rights. And next, George Eliasson's essay is titled, the next section is The Habsburgs and Bandera in the 1960s and 1970s. The Habsburg monarchy helped guide the leadership in their former possessions. The Freedom Council was formed by Otto von Habsburg and Jaroslav Stetsko at a conference in Munich, Germany on June 30th through July 2nd of 1967 as a coordinating body for organizations fighting communism in Europe. His Royal Highness Emperor Otto von Habsburg was honorary chairman of the European Freedom Council based in Munich during the 1980s and allied to the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. The European Freedom Council was founded in 1967 and in 1987 celebrated its 20th anniversary. The executive president at that time was British MP Mr. John Wilkinson, W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N, and one of two vice presidents was Mrs. Slava Stetsko of the ABN, of course, the wife and then widow of Yaroslav Stetsko. She became the head of ABN when her husband died, and also formed the Ukrainian National Congress with his personal, that is to say, her husband's personal secretary, Roman Zvarich. Zvarich was the justice minister, the equivalent of our attorney general under both Tymoshenko governments and the Yushchenko government in Ukraine, and is an advisor to President Poroshenko today. Continuing, talking about the European Freedom Council, sort of a Habsburg, Yaroslav Stetsko creation. The European Freedom Council, or EFC, which Yaroslav Stetsko co-founded and participated in, operated in close conjunction with the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. Annual conferences for the ABN and EFC were often held together, and the leadership of both organizations knew each other and corresponded regularly. The EFC functioned as ABN's Western counterpart and sought to, quote, mobilize support for the free world, for the subjugated nations' liberation struggle, unquote. A mass Western mobilization in support of ABN's disenfranchised delegates could only strengthen the united multinational ABN front, unquote. The administrative structure of the EFC resembled that of ABN, and the EFC represented anti-communist groups from Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, England, France, West Germany, Holland, Italy, Spain, Sweden, Turkey, and the U.S. The EFC extended into Asia with the Asian Pacific Anti-Communist League that included Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, China, that is to say Taiwan, Thailand, and Vietnam. Eastern European unity under Russian communism and the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, this is from a book by Alexander Nicholas Sosenko, this is the reference, Eastern European unity under Russian communism and the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. Continuing, the EFC further institutionalized and legitimized the ABN groups under Stetsko. All of the anti-communist working groups in every country were tied directly into the respective intelligence services and foreign policy dealing with the Soviet Union. This enhanced their standing and made their support part of national policy across Europe. How important were they? Slava Stetsko is the only major World War II Nazi figure ever to hold high national office anywhere in the world. By the way, that is not true. The deputy director of public liaison under Ronald Reagan was the former Ekaterina Chumachenko of the top OUNB front group in the U.S. She later became First Lady of the Ukraine when she married Viktor Yushchenko. We talked about that in, among other programs, For the Record 778 and For the Record 781. Continuing, I'm repeating this last sentence, couple of sentences. How important were they? Slava Stetsko is the only major World War II Nazi figure to ever hold high national office anywhere in the world. She had the support of a united Europe behind her. She was awarded the Medal of Freedom in the United States. The EFC gave her almost immediate access to all the European heads of state, and in Britain, the full support of Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party. Brian Crozier, C-R-O-Z-I-E-R, and the Institute for the Study of Conflict brought the influence Stetsko's ABN groups had in the UK to a peak under Margaret Thatcher. Started in the 1960s, his ISC became one of the best intel gatherers in the world. It's not many men that can start their own intelligence branch, but Brian Crozier did. Both MI5 and the CIA relied on his intelligence operations, developed through ties with the ABN, since the 1940s. When Stetsko helped co-found the World Anti-Communist League, it increased Crozier's value internationally and expanded his influence in the Western Hemisphere. And then quoting from Transnational Anti-Communism in the Cold War, Agents, Activities, and Networks, edited by Luc Van Dongen, Stephanie Roulin, and Gilles Scott Smith. Quote, from the 1950s onwards, Crozier set about exposing the true character of left-wing dictatorships and challenged the illusions of their Western apologists. By arguing that the West must stand up to communism, he helped provide the intellectual underpinning for the robust defense strategy championed by President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Crozier was a constant fixture lecturing at the Ministry of Defense about the communist threat. His view of it was exactly that of the ABN. Détente was weakness. The Soviet Union had to be dismantled. In 1991, it was. The Prometheanism Project started over 100 years ago, building an ultra-nationalist Ukraine and Eastern Europe as a buffer to Russia. It's called the Intermarium, I-N-T-E-R-M-A-R-I-U-M. The foundation of the renewed Baltic Black Sea region, or the Intermarium, started in the 1990s. In 1993, U.S. Presidential National Security Advisor Anthony Lake proclaimed the concept of expanding democracy. It provided for the involvement of former Eastern Bloc countries and Soviet republics, except for Russia, in transatlantic institutions. The Clinton administration launched NATO's eastward expansion in 1994 with a view to its implementation. The Kremlin adamantly objected to this policy. And the next section of George Eliason's essay, Nazi Europe. By the way, not talking about the 1940s, but today. When you look honestly at the fruit of the Habsburg Spring of Nations, Prometheanism, and the European and U.S.-supported Bandera, it is really staggering. Ukraine is only in the spotlight because it was the only place where regime change could come quickly. Many of the East European countries in the EU and NATO are already Nazi or are implementing the political groundwork for the establishment of ultra-national governance. Galicia, West Ukraine, Ruthenia, West Ukraine, Estonia, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Austria, Hungary, post-World War I Germany, Bosnia as well as Herzegovina, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, and Romania step into this model. The problem with these examples is that they are not cultural exceptions, but they are the rule. In 2007 at Tbilisi, Georgia, a statue of Prometheus was dedicated by Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili and Polish President Lech Kaczynski. Saakashvili has shown by his militant support for Nazi Kiev that he is a true believer in Prometheanism's ultra-nationalism. Before 1991, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, but from the West's perspective, where were the Ukrainians? Or more importantly, who were the Ukrainians? The Ukrainian National Republic had existed outside of Ukraine for over 80 years. It was a friend to the West, and its people were the Ukrainians. People inside of the Soviet Union were Soviet citizens, unless they were working with the Bandera operatives. Europe never met them. Europe never knew them. Europe did not and does not recognize the indigenous people of Ukraine unless they are given the stamp of approval by their longtime friend, the Ukrainian emigre population's leadership. In 1991, the president of the Ukrainian National Republic gave his power and the seal of state to Leonid Kuchma, K-U-C-H-M-A, who until then had been a communist leader in Kiev. Kuchma was born in Galicia, Poland, or Ukraine, and was for his entire life a Ukrainian ultranationalist. In accepting the seal, the flag of Galicia or Bandera, Kuchma agreed to bring the new state in line with the law and tradition of the Ukrainian National Republic circa 1919. In 2014, that is what finally happened. That was what Maidan was about. When Poroshenko gave his inaugural address, he paid homage to this fact. He said that the wars of 1917 to 1920 had finally been won. This was acknowledged by his election. This new Ukraine was now under the laws and traditions of 1920s Ukraine as demanded by Semyon Petliura. This was finally the Ukraine they had been waiting for. Today, ultranationalist Ukraine makes that clear by this genocidal war through which Kiev is choosing its citizens, i.e., parenthetically, I would add, ethnic cleansing. The conclusion of George Eliasson's essay, Why Doesn't Europe See or Hear the Donbass Genocide? Europe can't see Ukrainians being murdered or tortured, bombed or gassed, hacked with axes or beaten with stones because their longtime friend and ally assures them they would not do that to their own citizens, the Ukrainians. In Europe's view, the people in Donbass are an old Soviet relic that never represented Ukraine and needs to go away. Donbass was never a part of the Ukraine they know, not then and not now. Again, that is a George Eliasson essay. It is reproduced in its entirety in the description for the record 824 on the SpitfireList.com website. Now, against the background of that, consider the following two articles. This is from the German foreignpolicy.com newsletter, which feeds along the lower right-hand side of the SpitfireList.com website. This is called Honoring Collaborators from GermanForeignPolicy.com from November 26th of 2014. It reads in part, the Federal Republic of Germany has refused to vote in favor of a UN resolution condemning the glorification of National Socialism and Nazi collaboration. Last week, the Third Committee of the UN General Assembly passed a resolution strongly criticizing the edification of memorials to Nazi functionaries and the stylization of Nazi collaborators as, quote, freedom fighters, unquote. Germany and the other EU nations abstained. The USA, Canada, and Ukraine voted against the document, with 115 nations voting in favor. Skipping down. The UN resolution expresses its, quote, deep concern about the glorification in any form of the Nazi movement, neo-Nazism, and former members of the Waffen-SS organization. As examples, the document names erecting monuments and memorials and holding public demonstrations in the name of the glorification of the Nazi past, and also by attempting, quote, by attempting to declare such members and those who fought against the anti-Hitler coalition and collaborated with the Nazi movement participants in national liberation movements, unquote. The resolution explicitly, quote, emphasizes that any commemorative celebration of the Nazi regime, its allies, and related organizations, whether official or unofficial, should be prohibited by UN member states. The resolution especially expresses its condemnation of any denial or attempt to deny the Holocaust. Last Friday, when the Third Committee of the UN General Assembly put the resolution to a vote, the German ambassador to the UN found himself unable to cast his vote in favor. All other EU nations also abstained, along with countries dependent in one way or another on the EU, such as Andorra, Bosnia-Herzegovina, or Mali. Ukraine, the United States, and Canada voted point blank against the resolution. The latter two countries are sheltering rather influential Ukrainian exile communities characterized by former Nazi collaborators of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, and skipping down. However, had Germany and the other EU nations voted in favor of the resolution, it would necessarily have caused hefty disputes. Today, collaborators who had joined the Nazis in the war against Moscow are commemorated in several European countries. This is particularly true of Ukraine, when since early 2012, German organizations have been working, and intensively so since 2013, to incorporate the Svoboda Party and its affiliated forces into an anti-Russian alliance of organizations. Svoboda honors the OUN and particularly its commander Stefan Bandera, who is very popular throughout West Ukraine. In 1941, Bandera's militias all actively supported Nazi Germany in its attack on the Soviet Union. Svoboda also honors the Ukrainian Partisan Army, or UPA, which in the wake of the German War of Extermination had participated in mass murders of European Jews and Poles. In the course of the Maidan protests, both this party and other fascist organizations receiving vigorous support from Germany were playing a large role. Skipping down again. Again, much of this is review. Nazi collaborators are also being honored in EU member countries, for example, in the Baltic nations. Regular commemoration honor parades for the Waffen-SS, sponsored by their national Waffen-SS veterans, are organized in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. In Latvia, one of the most recent marches was held last spring with approximately 2,000 participants, which, in proportion to the size of the population, would correspond to a demonstration of 80,000 in Germany. Observers point out that in Riga's state-run Latvian Occupation Museum, unquote, the Latvian Waffen-SS militias are referred to as freedom fighters in the struggle against Moscow. Organizers of the Waffen-SS Memorial March are invited to schools to teach courses in, quote, patriotism, unquote. The All for Latvia National Alliance Party, which has consistently been in the government since 2011, supports these parades. And that entire article is in the description for the record, 824. And again, I think the OUN, or the Ukrainian diaspora that George Eliason referred to, obviously looms large, decisively large, in the background of that article. The U.S. and Canada have enormous Ukrainian emigre groups. Michael Bashurku, head of the OSCE's special observer mission in Ukraine, is a Ukrainian exile or emigre from the OUNB milieu in Canada, also maintains networking with Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood figures who loom large in the background of the disappearance of not only the Malaysian airliner that, quote, vanished, unquote, earlier this year, but also MH Flight 17 that was shot down in Ukraine. Again, bearing in mind the Promethean League, the Ukrainian diaspora, and the larger definition of Bandera as specified by George Eliason in that essay, we're going to conclude with the following. This is from the Kiev Post of November 27th of 2014, an article by Katya, K-A-T-Y-A, Gorshinskaya, G-O-R-C-H-I-N-S-K-A-Y-A. Poroshenko wants to see foreigners heading Ukraine's FBI fill cabinet positions. Basically, again, President Poroshenko wants to bring in people from abroad, primarily from the U.S., Lithuania, and Georgia. By the way, countries pivotally influenced by the Promethean ABN Intermarium European Freedom Council dynamic that George Eliason goes into. This article reads in part, President Petro Poroshenko asked the new parliament to amend legislation to allow foreigners to take up jobs in the nation, including head of the Anti-Corruption Bureau. Skipping down. I have a concrete suggestion to all who is involved, according to procedures spelled out in law, to the appointment in this extremely important institution. I suggest inviting to this job a person from outside Ukraine, unquote. Poroshenko told the new parliament on Thursday, the day of its opening. By the way, in our last couple of programs about Ukraine, for the record, 817 and 818, we took a look at the lustration law, ostensibly an anti-corruption law. It's actually anti-Russian. And again, the Ukrainian diaspora and the roughly 100-plus years-long dynamic that was cited by George Eliason is front and center here. Skipping down. My idea, this is Poroshenko speaking, quote, my idea is by changing the law to allow foreigners into state service, including government seats, or extend the list of persons the president can grant Ukrainian citizenship to through fast tracking, unquote, Poroshenko said. Poroshenko's administration hired an international recruiting company, Korn Ferry, that's K-O-R-N-F-E-R-R-Y, and its local branch, W-E Partners, to identify candidates for the next government. They approached foreigners in Ukraine and abroad. They are American, Lithuanian, and Georgian nationals, according to Insider UA, a Ukrainian site that specializes in political news. So again, that is, I think, directly reflective of and part and parcel to the dynamic cited by George Eliason in his essay. Again, there's a long article-length description for the record, 824, if the admittedly very pedantic format that I use here is a bit much for some people's taste, and I can imagine that it is. Just go to the website and you can read all about it, as they used to say in journalism. And be aware, again, that you can subscribe to the comments that are offered up by on a regular basis by Terra Fractal, a very important contributing editor, and others as well. That will keep you informed of updates not only to articles I've done and programs I've done, but other stories as well. So please do that. There's a place to click on at the top of the description for 824 and on the front page so that you can subscribe to the comments. This concludes, for the record, 824, bringing it all back home Ukrainian style, the evolution and triumph of Ukrainian fascism. This has been recorded on December 4th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.